organization, toward complexity, toward also vulnerability, but freedom and creativity, moving to higher levels, through periods of stability and periods of instability, through long periods of boredom and short periods of transformation. In fact, one biologist, Professor Ager, said that all biological evolution seems to resemble the life of a soldier. Life of a soldier, which is basically long periods of boredom interspersed with short periods of terror. And if we get on now toward our own condition in humanity, we find that whatever period of boredom there may have been in the Middle Ages, they weren't very long, but there were certain amount of stability on lack of major change for a number of centuries, has come to an end. Has come to an end already in the 19th century, and we are heading toward a period of change. And if we are clever, it will not be a period of terror, but a period of creative change, a new phase change into something else, into a greater level of unity. Alright, just a short remark. Because looking into the future, let me first of all say that I've been very inspired and very pleased to have received, alas, only 2 weeks ago, the new book by Dr. Hossein Danesh and on Unity, the Creative Foundation of Peace. And I quite agree with what he writes, among others, there. And let me quote one or two sentences from him. He says that in the final analysis, all successful transformation of human societies must of necessity conform to universal laws of growth. This is what I have been talking about, the universal laws of growth. But he adds, and I quite agree, that the growth dynamics of societies, the same as of human beings, are natural as well as intentional. While they must respect the universal laws of evolution, they can exploit the freedom within the laws to create the kind of growth and development that makes us and our world diverse, united, and beautiful. So when we talk about the new world order, these are the concepts that we have to keep in mind. Natural as well as intentional. These are the natural laws of growth, of evolution. They're very permissive, because as I said, they're highly creative. The more complex a system, the more creative it can be. So, intentional evolution comes into play. We could master our own evolution. And then I'm struck again by another passage from Shoghi Effendi. Even though I'm sure you know it all by heart, let me just take a moment to read it. Because this is a prophetic insight which I find of very great validity. This is what he says. A world community in which all economic barriers will have been permanently demolished and the interdependence of capital and labor definitely recognized, in which the clamor of religious fanaticism and strife will have been forever stilled, in which the flame of racial animosity will have been finally extinguished, in which a single code of international law, the product of the considered judgment of the world's federated representatives, shall have as its sanction the instant and coercive intervention of the combined forces of the federated units. And finally, a world community in which the fury of a capricious and militant nationalism will have been transmuted into an abiding consciousness of world citizenship. Such, indeed, appears in its broadest outline the order anticipated by Baha'u'llah, an order that shall come to be regarded as the fairest fruits of a slowly maturing age. And as he adds, let me just continue, it calls for a wider loyalty, for a larger aspiration than any that has animated the human race. It insists upon the subordination of national impulses and interests to the imperative claims of a unified world. It repudiates excessive centralization on one hand and disclaims all attempts at uniformity on the other. Its watchword is unity in diversity. I was tremendously gratified yesterday and pleased that Madame Rabbani emphasized the same factor. Because what the Baha'i prophecy tells us about the future of humankind anticipates to a remarkable degree the conclusions of this independently derived application of these new sciences of complexity. For the Baha'i prophecy outlines a system formed on the global planetary level of organization by these complex cycles, the so-called hypercycles, connecting the functioning of diverse yet harmonized nations, peoples and cultures. When the new world order arrives, today's nation states will have given up their claims of unconditional sovereignty and acknowledged their membership in the human family. As Shoghi Effendi said, what else could these weighty words signify if they did not point to the inevitable curtailment of unfettered national sovereignty as an indispensable preliminary to the formation of the future commonwealth of all the nations of the world? Let me have the next and last slide. That's the lower part, okay. A little higher. We can, it's the last thing I'd like you to look at. If you apply these insights from the sciences, combining with the prophetic insights from the founders of the Baha'i faith, you will see a harmonious development which accelerates tremendously. Because perhaps it accelerates as we are now entering the critical phases of adolescence, collective adolescence. It moves from simple societies, but are highly stable. You know that about 99% of the time of all societies on Earth, all organized human societies, have been spent in the Stone Age. In Stone Age societies, they were highly stable, highly integrated in their environment. Hunting-gathering societies. They have been destabilized by the invention, among other things, of fire, of the domestication of animals, of agriculture, the Neolithic revolution. New kinds of societies came about. Agrarian, pastoral societies transforming into agricultural societies. These societies, in turn, through the invention of writing, communication, growing technologies, the wheel, better modes of transportation, the charting of the seas, etc., transforming into higher level, more complex societies, fewer and fewer people engaged in growing food, in taking care of the necessities of life, more and more people being able to engage in cultural pursuits, in intellectual pursuits, until today, you know, a very small percentage of the labor force works in the so-called primary sectors of agriculture and the most basic goods for survival. More and more of us are working now in the services, more and more in the cultural, intellectual fields. As we move up, the chances, the perspectives, the freedom of choice increases. Could I have it this side, please? The other side, yeah. As we move from these agricultural societies, we move toward the feudal, if you like, pre-industrial societies, industrial societies. Now we are moving into post-industrial societies. And these post-industrial societies are now operating in such a way in which they are becoming strongly interdependent. And this is the last point I'd like to make, but I'd like to make it as clearly as I can, and as forcefully as I can. You hear a great deal about living in a global village. I don't believe we do. I think we live in a kind of a global, interdependent world locked into a lot of national and local villages. We are locked together in an interdependence, but we do not know how to make use of this interdependence. We are at each other's throats. Mankind is one. We are all its citizens, but we haven't created yet that state of which we could be joint citizens. Despite of the many signs of interdependence, despite of the many efforts of international organizations, the United Nations, the many regional bodies, the many, many international private sector organizations such as multinational corporations, non-governmental organizations, and so on. Despite of this, the world is today in a highly unstable condition. It is moving from one crisis to another. And we have to realize that this age of maturity that we're awaiting is yet to be achieved. We are operating on this threshold of a major change, of a major phase change, of a major transformation. And to my mind, if I look for hopeful signs, the hopeful signs are not directly in the achievements of multinational corporations in accords or resolutions reached in the United Nations. These could be all important elements, but they are not decisive elements. These are all progress, signs of progress, which is far too slow to keep pace with the growth of interdependence, with the growth of the human population, now 5 billion at this moment, growing toward over 6 billion by the turn of the century, and this tremendous appetite it has for technology, for energy, for information, tremendous rising expectations. To keep pace with all this, we do have to create some kind of a globally extended civilization. And these tiny steps that we are taking today are not sufficient to get us there. So there will be a major change. This system, as it is now, even with the signs of progress that it makes, is not sustainable. I cannot see it on the basis of the information that I've had at my disposal in the United Nations, on the basis of the discussions we are having in the Club of Rome, or anywhere else. I cannot see how this present system could survive into the 21st century. There is going to be a major change. And in this major change, the seeds of the new order will come to blossom. And those seeds that we plant today will have the chance to blossom into a new order tomorrow. Because what I want to, as a final thought, what I want to leave with you is this. Freedom is a marvelous thing, but it's also dangerous. Because it can lead us into a new world that is creative, that is fulfilling, that is humane. It can also lead us into a new world that is repressive, that is inhumane, that is full of terror. If Hitler could have established his 1,000-year Reich and enforced it with the nuclear bomb, we would have had a reign of terror for a long time. Perhaps not for 1,000 years, but perhaps in our lifetime. This is always a possibility. The laws of evolution will not dictate the exact kind of society that will emerge. I am convinced that unless, through some incredible stupidity or accident, we'll wipe ourselves off the face of this earth through a nuclear catastrophe, unless that happens, we will create a global society. But what kind of society? That is the key issue. We could create a global dictatorship. Hopefully we will create a humane society, a society in which the individual can grow, can develop, can become a citizen and a participating agent of this new world. And for this reason, I think movements such as yours, such as the one in which we're all participating in this moment, have such crucial importance. These are the seeds which today are repressed, but tomorrow we'll have the chance to grow. I hope we can all grow with it. Thank you very much.
A few minutes for questions. There are mics placed in the audience. And if you'd like to ask a question, would you please go to a mic? Yes.
Dr. Laszlo, I'm interested in the dynamics of the instability. as you referred, our classical understanding of evolution and growth is having some sort of impetus that's pushing it. We now realize that it seems to be more of a relationship between what you call favorable conditions, a sort of a fertility and a potency. Occurrence of civilization hallmarked the introduction of a totally new type of organism, and that is human consciousness. And we have seen that evolve itself into finally a state of maturity and a recognition of many of the things that our social sciences are realizing as well. And I'm just wondering if you would comment on the dynamics of instability. We know that we're not pushed out of periods of stability. And there seems to be a relationship between the fertility of some sort of stability in relationship to a new potency that makes new things possible. Maybe you would comment on that in terms of the development of human consciousness and its awareness of itself.
It's a very, very potent question. It would call for an entire new discussion. Perhaps we can continue it informally.
Couple of questions.
One, as your attention seems to be focused in such a highly specialized way upon a specific reality, I wonder if you believe in the concept that consciousness creates reality. Repeat it all?
Repeat the question.
No, just the consciousness
creates. As your attention seems to be focused in a highly specialized way upon a specific reality, I wonder if you believe in the concept that consciousness creates reality.
Okay, sure.
I have a couple of other questions, too. Maybe I'll give them all to you at once. The other one is, in lieu of your... I'm shaking, I'm nervous. In lieu of your acceptance of the universal laws of growth and evolutionary laws, do you believe that man has free will? And why are you not at the high?
Why am I not at the high? Let me answer the last one first. Maybe I am. I would say no to the first question, but not an unqualified no. The question was, does consciousness create reality? I think reality was there before there was consciousness in the human species. If the human species would disappear, in fact, if all higher species endowed with consciousness in the universe, and I'm convinced there are many, would disappear, the universe would still be there. This is a basic realism, if you like, which I share with almost all natural scientists. I think consciousness shapes reality, yes. I think consciousness, to a remarkable extent, can control, can dominate reality if it becomes fully cognizant of it, within limits. I don't think the laws of nature are the creation of consciousness. I think we, with our consciousness, we can grasp these laws to a more or less precise extent. The better we grasp them, the better we can use them. The more altruistically we use them, the more we use them to further all of evolution within our sphere, the better it is for us. We cannot be perhaps selfish, but it's another argument, because eventually it'll backfire on us, because we don't evolve, the whole universe evolves, and the whole planet evolves in this case. And we evolve within that. This also, to some extent, perhaps answers the question of